from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Ukrainians say the Kiev government is not in control. A changing Syrian refugee crisis in Jordan.
People need to settle somehow for a longer time period.
A U.S. lawmaker vows to block American military aid to Egypt. And the owner of a U.S. basketball team is banned for life from the NBA. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Pro-Russian gunmen have seized yet another administrative building in eastern Ukraine. Armed insurgents, early today, took control of the city council building in Horlivka, a city of more than 260,000 people. Hundreds of pro-Russian separatists Tuesday attacked a police station with clubs and automatic weapons and seized a prosecutor's office in Luhansk. Luhansk is one of the largest cities in eastern Ukraine. Insurgents have seized control of police stations and other government buildings in at least 10 cities and towns. The demonstrators who stormed the building in Luhansk, like those elsewhere in the east, seek a referendum on granting greater authority to Ukraine's regions.
Народна власть, которая сидит в СБУ, наши герои, защитники.
One mass demonstrator told the Associated Press that the people's government in Luhansk had promised that the Kiev authorities hold a peaceful referendum. At a news conference in Kiev Tuesday, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt says it's been suggested to the interim government in Kiev that they carefully deal with the pro-Russian insurgents occupying buildings in eastern Ukraine.
Our advice would be to encourage the government to continue on the course that it has been pursuing of seeking a strategy to cordon these cities, to use their security forces and the army if necessary, to ensure that weapons, money, instability are not trafficked in and out of these cities, but not to engage in the forceful clearing of these buildings.
Ambassador Pyatt also spoke about a possible U.S. response should Russian troops cross the border into eastern Ukraine.
Russian troops crossing Ukraine's borders would be a major escalation and would draw an inevitable sharp reaction from the United States. And I think that's understood by everybody. It would be a dramatically unfortunate development, which I think would produce only the most tragic consequences.
Russia has massed tens of thousands of troops in areas near the Ukrainian border, feeding concerns that Moscow aims to use unrest in the east as a pretext for an invasion. NATO is boosting defense in member nations bordering Russia to allay their growing concerns about Moscow's territorial ambitions. Zlatissa Hoch has that part of the story.
Ukraine and its allies have accused Russia of fueling the crisis in eastern Ukraine to clear the way for another incursion into the region after annexing the Crimean Peninsula. NATO member nations bordering Russia have asked the alliance for additional protection. Deputy Supreme Allied Commander in Europe Adrian Bradshaw visited Latvia Tuesday to discuss measures to strengthen NATO's presence in the Baltic region.
Our judgment is that the actions that we've taken at the moment are proportionate and appropriate to the changed security dynamic that we face. It gives a very clear indication of NATO commitment to the region, but the things we're doing could not be considered to be threatening to anybody outside the region.
NATO already has increased its air policing and naval presence in the Baltics. Last week, 450 U.S. paratroopers were deployed in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and another 150 in Poland. NATO military exercises are taking place across the region. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Tuesday said NATO is sending a clear message to Moscow that its territory is inviolable. He also called on NATO members to meet their financial obligations.
We cannot continue to allow Allied defense budgets to shrink. Clearly, not all allies are going to meet the NATO benchmark of 2% of GDP overnight or even next year. But it's time for allies who are below that level to make credible commitments to increase their spending on defense over the next 5 years. And if we're going to move the trend line in a positive direction, this has to be an alliance-wide effort.
Russia has accused the West of stirring unrest in the region. But some Eastern Europeans who still recall Russian invasions say they feel safer with an increased NATO presence. Lithuanian student Ernestas Tuzinas says he wants even more.
These are only the first steps. NATO should set up a permanent military base in Lithuania.
The Baltic states spent five decades under Soviet occupation until 1991 and joined NATO in 2004. Poland joined in 1999 and was among the first Eastern European NATO members. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
A recent survey found that Ukrainians have little faith in the interim government that replaced ousted President Viktor Yanukovych, with the majority of respondents telling pollsters it has little control over events buffeting the country. Jamie Detmer reports from Kiev.
It probably isn't what the U.S. government wanted to hear from an opinion poll it funded. Still, a survey conducted for the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, or IFES, a Washington-based international non-profit organization that assists elections in new and emerging democracies, found that Ukrainians think their country's in the grip of chaos and don't believe the interim government is effective. The poll, which was conducted in mid-April, found that there are widespread doubts about the legitimacy and effectiveness of the government of acting Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk. The poll illustrates the scale of the challenge facing the interim government, not only in Ukraine's troubled east, where hardcore pro-Russian separatists stormed several government buildings in the city of Luhansk on Monday, but across the country. Rakesh Sharma is a research director at IFES, which receives most of its funding from the US State Department and the United Nations.
In Ukraine overall, 23% of respondents say that the government has full control or significant control in the country. But you have 27% saying that it has no control at all, and 45% saying that it's not in much control of the situation in the country.
In the rest of East, 80% of respondents said they consider the interim government illegitimate, a much higher percentage than anywhere else in Ukraine.
In Kharkiv and Donetsk, in those focus groups, what we heard were people saying primarily that this government does not represent us. We do not feel like our interests are being represented by this government, and that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the direction of the country and the way it was headed.
Many pro-unity Ukrainians are also unimpressed by the interim government.
Even in the Kharkiv and Donetsk focus groups, people who had pro-Ukrainian views, people who wanted those regions to stay part of the country, even they would express a lot of concerns about the government.
With the unrest spreading in the east, where pro-Russian separatists have seized more than 30 government buildings in at least a dozen towns, the government admitted Wednesday that its forces are helpless to quell unrest by pro-Russian activists. Kiev and Western governments say the agitation is being encouraged by Moscow. The Kremlin denies it is fueling the unrest. Some analysts and activists now argue that Kiev mishandled the East and never took the region's grievances, many of which are economic, seriously enough. They say the stalled military campaign to combat pro-Russian separatists has only aggravated the problem. That is a view U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt may share. On Tuesday, he disclosed he had advised the Kiev government against the use of force to combat separatists. Pyatt also defended the latest round of targeted sanctions imposed by the United States on Russia, saying they could influence the thinking of Moscow.
I think it's way too early to write off these sanctions as inconsequential. I've seen some commentary saying, oh, it's not enough. But I think if you look at the kind of losses Russian markets have faced over the past weeks, I think it's quite a bit too early to say that these actions are not going to have a significant impact on the calculus of the Russian government.
With discontent rising, the Kiev government will hope the ambassador is right. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
The humanitarian organization International Relief and Development says the needs of its Jordan program, aimed at helping about 750,000 Syrian refugees, is changing. Jordan is reported under stress due to the continuing influx of those fleeing the fighting in Syria. Uma Kundalaiva is the IRD Jordan director, and she spoke with us about the current situation. She says it has moved from an emergency stage to a long crisis phase.
Last year or year and a half ago, when Syrians just came to Jordan and Lebanon, none of them were expected to stay more than 2-3 months. Each of them had this short-term sort of survival mood. Then, yes, we need to survive. We need to make our, you know, to meet our basic needs for 2-3 months. And very soon, war or conflict would be settled back home. That was mood of most Syrians, and that was expectations for the humanitarian agencies, including the IRD and UNHCR, on design of very quick sort of emergency-related interventions only. Unfortunately, situation is changing dramatically, where crisis, unfortunately, crisis in Syria does not seem to be resolved in a short time period, which means many of the Syrians would not be going back home within next 2-3 months, but most probably should stay outside of the country, which means automatically then they have now completely different needs compared to year and a half ago, when that was simple needs on like basic food, water, some basic stuff, shelter they need, and it's temporary. Versus now, people need settled somehow for a longer time period.
So what are you doing to help these people settle for a longer period of time?
Basically, every component, every program we design have a psychosocial component of it, because people need to be counseled and need to be prepared for longer stay. Very important for Syrians to give them chance to be self-sustained, just to give them chance to be busy with something productive for themselves and for their families. We should not be creating programs which might lead to the dependency on humanitarian aid versus to enroll Syrians very actively to help themselves. It is very important now for us, as well as all international agencies, all UN partners, start to address Jordanian communities who are hosting the Syrians. Jordanians and Lebanese communities have a great level of hospitality, and they were hosting refugees for quite some time. They were welcoming refugees in the beginning. They were providing them basic assistance for quite some time. But now we see the level of vulnerability of host communities are decreasing too. It means a lot of efforts need to be done to address whole population together, host population as well as refugees living with this host population, because problems are now affecting everyone. It's not only Syrian refugees who are vulnerable. There are lots of Jordanian families who host Syrian refugees 2 years ago, 1 year ago, but the poverty level is now really making these families vulnerable themselves.
Is there anything that you need? Is there anything that you think that would help you with your project?
There is a serious lack of funding. And because crisis is becoming sort of too long, we start facing donor fatigue. We start, you know, see the depletion of funding in general. It's too expensive to run longer-term operations. That's one of the serious problems, where funding were available for short-term emergency relief interventions, but it is more and more difficult for us to raise funds for longer-term development type of interventions, which will address Syrian refugees and Jordanian communities and Lebanese communities who are hosting these refugees.
Uma Kundalaiva is the IRD Jordan director, speaking with us from Amman. U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy says he intends to block aid to Egypt's military unless he sees convincing evidence the interim military-backed government is committed to the rule of law. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the lawmaker's statement came as Egyptian Foreign Minister Nabil Elfami met with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and insisted his country is moving forward on the path to democracy.
Speaking Tuesday on the Senate floor, Patrick Leahy, chairman of the subcommittee on the State Department and Foreign Operations, denounced what he called the sham trial Monday, during which a court reportedly sentenced to death nearly 700 supporters of ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. Leahy called it a flaunting of human rights by the Egyptian government and an appalling abuse of the justice system, which he said is fundamental to democracy.
Nobody can justify this. It does not show democracy. It shows a dictatorship run amok. It is a total violation of human rights. So I'm not prepared to sign off on the delivery of additional aid for the Egyptian military. I'm not prepared to do that until we see convincing evidence the government is committed to the rule of law.
Monday, the United States said it was deeply troubled by the mass death sentence verdict. White House officials said it defies even the most basic standards of international justice. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon expressed alarm, saying the verdicts appear not to meet basic fair trial standards, and they're likely to undermine prospects for long-term stability. The case stemmed from deadly riots last year after security forces violently disbanded protests held by Muslim Brotherhood supporters. Last month, the same court in Minya sentenced 529 defendants to death, drawing similar international criticism. Meeting in Washington Tuesday with Fahmy, Kerry insisted the United States wants the interim Egyptian government to be successful.
We are hopeful and look for a political process of inclusivity, a constitution implemented, which brings people politically to the table and broadens the democratic base of Egypt.
Kerry called the recent court rulings disturbing decisions that raise serious challenges. Fahmy said the judicial system in Egypt is independent of the government.
I can't comment on the content of the decisions themselves, but I'm confident that due process is allowed, appeal process is allowed, and that the legal system will ultimately end up with the proper decisions in each of these cases.
He said his country will build a democracy based on the rule of law. The Egyptian diplomat said the people want democracy and a better future. Fahmy said the country is moving forward, pointing to the constitution, presidential elections next month to be followed by parliamentary elections. The Obama administration has relaxed a ban on military aid to Cairo imposed in the wake of the violence that followed Mr. Morsi's ouster last year. Last week, the Defense Department announced $650 million in military aid and 10 Apache helicopters for Cairo. Tuesday, Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby said the aid has the blessing of the President, Barack Obama, and Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel.
This is a relationship that, from a military to military perspective, that matters. It's important, and we want to see it continue.
Kirby said the aid is for Egypt's security requirements in the Sinai and promised to consult closely with members of Congress and keep them informed as the aid moves forward. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
The World Health Organization says it believes the recent spike in cases of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, coronavirus, is probably due to a seasonal increase of the disease rather than to any changes in the behavior of the virus. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says there is nothing unusual about the recent spike in cases of MERS coronavirus. It says similar upsurges have occurred around the same time in the past 2 years. WHO spokesman Gregory Hartle says the increase in cases is most likely due to the warmer weather in the Arabian Peninsula and to outbreaks of the disease in 2 or 3 hospitals in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. He says health officials do not know how the virus is transmitted from person to person, but it is clear, he says, the disease does not spread with the same ease that severe acute respiratory syndrome or SARS did.
We don't think it does transmit very efficiently, and it's certainly not anything like SARS or like diseases like influenza. There's no way we can predict the future. But for us at the moment, certainly this virus, MERS, does not have the ability to infect in the same way that SARS did. So that is a good sign.
Hartl says SARS is highly contagious. The disease broke out in China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan in the early 2000s. Over a six-month period at the height of the epidemic, nearly 8,100 cases and 774 deaths were reported. By comparison, Hartl notes, WHO has confirmed 261 cases of MERS coronavirus in 2 years. But the downside is that 93 people have died, which is a much higher fatality rate than that of SARS. The MERS coronavirus is shrouded in mystery. Health officials know that camels are one of the hosts of the virus, but they believe the disease may also stem from other sources. They also do not know why some humans get infected and others do not. The virus made its first appearance in Egypt last week. Cases also have been confirmed in Greece, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Indonesia. But WHO spokesman Hartl says patients in those countries acquired the disease while they were in Saudi Arabia. He says the virus remains largely contained in the Middle East. He says the virus has not changed its character. 30 viruses have been tested, he says, and none have mutated.
These viruses don't transmit from human to human because when they transmit from human to human, small changes in the genome of the virus will occur. However, in this case, we believe that this means that almost all the introductions still are coming from the environment somehow.
Hartl says health officials are faced with the big challenge of trying to figure out how the virus passes from its natural host or reservoir to humans. The World Health Organization says in the absence of any drugs to treat the disease, the best way people can protect themselves from falling ill is to practice good general hygiene. WHO says people should wash their hands frequently and keep their distance from people who show signs of MERS. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The owner of the Los Angeles Clippers of the U.S. National Basketball Association has been banned from the league for life because of racist remarks he made about African Americans in an audio recording. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver announced that Donald Sterling also is being fined $2.5 million, the maximum amount allowed under NBA rules. Indiana Pacers head coach Frank Vogel reacted to Silver's decision regarding Sterling.
I applaud the commissioner. You know, I think it's a great show of force by our commissioner. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about, you know, we don't need that kind of stuff in our league. I don't think we need that kind of stuff in our world.
On that audio recording, a male voice is heard asking a woman who is of Latino and African heritage not to post photos of African Americans on her Instagram page and to not bring African Americans to his basketball games. The Clippers are now competing in the NBA playoffs. Indiana Pacers' David West, whose team was also in the playoffs, spoke about the NBA decision regarding Donald Sterling.
I mean, he's 80 years old, so his life ain't that much, don't have that much more life to live. So, I mean, you know, I guess it's good. You know, I'm glad that they did something to remove him. He still has ownership. Still is going to profit from the team, but it's a step in the right direction.
A number of the LA Clippers advertisers have begun canceling or suspending their sponsorships of the team. The NBA is a diverse, multicultural professional league in which about 70% of the players are black, and it includes nearly 100 players from almost 40 countries. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day by coming on by our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.